Hey, are you tired of meeting with prospects only to have them put you off again and again, turning them into yet another missed opportunity? Are you tired of trying to do the same things in meetings and not seeing any improvement in the amount of business you're closing? Do you want to stop giving your time away in hopes that a client will buy something or someday transfer their assets? Well, Whiteboard University is our two-hour live workshop where we will teach you how to have engaging meetings with every prospect and client you meet with, how to quantify your advice so prospects are willing and excited to pay you a financial planning fee, and finally, where we teach you how to explain financial strategies in a dynamic, interesting way that will separate you from all the boring advisors who do the same old thing. If you're serious about having better client meetings and closing business faster, visit WhiteboardU.com today and sign up for one of our live workshops in November. Whiteboard University offers a 100% money-back guarantee if we don't help you improve your communication and meeting skills. That's WhiteboardU.com. We'll see you there.
Andrea, thank you for being here. I'm really excited to have you. This is not a typical podcast that we do as financial planners, and we're talking about prospecting and helping people with their money. But as I got to know you and read your background, I'm a dad of three and a business owner. And so everybody listening is a financial advisor in the insurance industry, investment industry, owns a business and busy schedules. But a lot of our listeners have kids, will have kids. And so I wanted to have a conversation with you today about what are some blind spots? What's the state of where things are now? Before we start, if you could kind of give us a background on your journey and what brought you to where you are now.
Yeah. So hello. My journey is one that for the longest time, 27 years to be exact, I held it pretty close to my chest. And that's because when I was 11 years old, my brother, who was 18 at the time, Francisco for short, was murdered by someone who he considered a friend. And it rocked our family because we were a close-knit Mexican family. Yes, I know I look white. There's a whole explanation behind that. But it rocked our close-knit sarcastic family. And I remember fast forwarding 2 years, and my parents and I were in the courtroom. And I had just stepped inside of the witness stand to read my impact statement. And my mom delivered hers. My dad didn't. And the district attorneys read both of my older brother's impact statements because they weren't allowed to be in the room simply because they didn't know whether or not they could trust themselves not to go after the person who had murdered their younger brother. Yeah. And so I remember sitting there and the judge comes back after a recess and he looks at my parents and me and he pauses and he takes this deep breath and then he goes, I'm not sentencing this man to death, not because of moral or professional objections against the death penalty, but simply because he had a rough life. And I sat there in the courtroom completely flabbergasted, being like, wait, so because he had a rough childhood full of abuse and neglect and all sorts of things that I would not wish upon any child, he kind of gets an out. And so compared to my family, who was like this loving, close-knit, sarcastic family. And so from that moment on, I went on my mission, you know, as a 13-year-old of like, okay, never again, like no more of this. And so I became a clinical child psychologist who specializes in the treatment of antisocial and aggressive youth so that other kids don't get raised in those environments. And if they do get raised in those environments, they can have become agents in their own lives and develop coping skills to overcome the stars that, you know, were put in place for them. And so that's kind of what I do as a clinical child psychologist.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's the journey, and I think the maybe the misconception at times is there's the extreme negative childhood, and then there's everybody else. And from my story and a lot of advisors I talk to, like there's we've all been impacted by something. We all carry stuff with us, whether we're aware of it or not. Where in your work and what have you learned in that space of like, this affects more children than we probably think of to some degree?
Yeah. So right now, America is in a youth mental health crisis. And most people, if they are aware of it, they don't realize how significant it is of how strong, like how much our children and our teens are suffering. We have a high amount of teens that are reporting that their mental health is not good. We have a high amount of teens saying that they feel hopeless, which is a predictor or a warning sign for suicide. And then leading into that, we have 18% of youth have said that they have thought about killing themselves in the last year. Where like 10% have come up with a plan. And then I think it's like 1-3%, usually somewhere in there, have died by suicide in the last year. Wow. And so like when we're talking about mental health of our youth, it like we are in pretty bad situations that we found ourselves in. But I don't think a lot of people are aware because they just kind of see their own kids or like the kids that their friends are, that their kids are friends with, but they don't see the what's going on in the global country or not global country because it's not global, but in the overall nation.
Yeah. What's the blind spot? I feel like this is an easy thing to say, hey, yeah, that affects, you know, other places. And I'm in Nashville, Tennessee by many standards. It's like, hey, this is a pretty safe place to live. You know, parents are fairly involved, nationally good schools. But I'm, you know, I'm reading some books and seeing things and I get, you know, feedback from other parents. I'm like, wait, that stuff's going on in our schools. And so I almost feel like, and maybe this is true for a lot of our listeners, that we are operating in the world of money. So a lot of times we're around people, our clients are people that have money and have comfortable lives. What's the blind spot for the comfortable many to where it doesn't feel like it's just so obvious in front of our face? But I have two girls and a boy. At what age is it like, hey, this is, you need to kick in or be more attentive. You need to ask these questions. What, and I'd love to get into practical steps later, but for our audience right now that may at some point being like, hey, the extreme doesn't affect us, I think I'm good. What would you say to them?
It's actually, so like, as you mentioned, Sten, it's not for people that like your audience, it's probably not like the people, the families that were the, you know, similar to the families of the person that like murdered my brother. But it's the complete opposite. It's the parents who are uber involved and are wanting to do all the things and wanting their children to succeed, but with these high hopes and like pushing their children, what they're forgetting is they're forgetting to let their child be independent and autonomous and like letting their child fail and like learning those skill sets of like, okay, what do you do when you fail? What do you do when, like, how do we get our kids to be independent and so that they're doing things for themselves? Like, we're having, I mean, there's a woman, she calls herself the phone lady, and she charges like, I think it's like $470 an hour to teach millennials and what's the generation underneath us? Is that
not Z? It's probably X. I think it's
Gen X. Z. It's X. How to talk on a phone because like they haven't ever had to do those things. And I was like, I want that job. Like, I want to teach younger, like someone pay me $470 to say hello and like listen to what the person says to you. But it's, we're doing too much for our kids and we're forgetting to let them figure things out all on their own.
Is that a kind of an overcompensation based on a prior generation? I know if I look at my own story, there was a, you know, some parents that were like, my parents weren't involved at all, so I'm going to, that's never going to happen again. And so is it an overcorrection, or what's the, what is that resulting from?
Yeah. So I think what's going on is like, yeah, we have our pendulum. There's a pendulum swing, right? So like, we're like, oh, we don't want to be anything like our parents who were, you know, more dismissive and like didn't really focus on our feelings too much. And now the pendulum has swung the complete opposite way. Mm-hmm. And now we start to see things like gentle parenting being promoted. And we're seeing that gentle parenting is not where it's at either. Mm-hmm. And that we're creating anxious kids, and we're creating kids that can't do things for themselves. And so like what we really need to do is we need to come back. We've forgotten that there's like this nice middle ground. That's usually the sweet spot for a lot of things, is kind of that middle moderation spot. And that's where kids are going to have the best developmental outcomes. That's how we set our kids up to be adaptable youth. And once kids can be adaptable, then they can be successful regardless of what environment they find themselves in.
Yeah, I went through an interesting time where I had my kids going to counseling after we had some life stuff happen, and then heard and even got some feedback on, you don't want to have your kids in counseling forever. Like at some point they need to get to a place where they're talking to their friends or their family, because an adult is potentially mature enough to decide when they're done with counseling, or to even push back if something doesn't seem to fit, where a child is just, I'm going to receive it and whatever you say must be true. And so that was surprising for me that after 6 months, they're like, no, they've transitioned well, and now they need to go do this stuff on their own, which is hard. They're not going to do it right every time, but like they need that process.
Right. And like a lot of the time, like when clients are coming to see me, especially like kiddos, like young children, it's like a lot of them right now are for anxiety, different like OCD, social anxiety, phobias, those kind of things. And I look at the parents and I'm like, look, this is going to be like an 8 to 16 week treatment, or 8 to 16 session therapy, and then your child is like out of here. And I always crack the joke, and the kids usually love this. I'm like, I want you to fire me because I don't want, like, it's not that I don't like you.
Forever job,
It's just like, I don't want to be in your life forever. And so it's like, we're going to get you the knowledge and we're giving you the skills so that you can be successful all on your own, because you can do difficult things, you can adapt to whatever situation you're in. And so I think parents really appreciate that, because it's like, no, it's like, this is like an 8 to 16 session fix, which is if we do every week, it's somewhere between 2 months to 4 months, and then you are out of here. And obviously there might be maintenance that comes along the way. Like I remember I had one youth that came in, he was a teenager, because he was super sensitive to certain sounds. And he would become really anxious and irritated and flustered to certain sounds. A lot of like chewing, like the people that like kind of like cow chewers. And so we worked on that last summer. And then all of a sudden I saw that youth back on my caseload this year, and they came in. I was like, what's going on? And they're like, well, we know that you do sports performance coaching for like youth.
Oh, wow.
And he plays these sports, and so like now he's struggling with those. Can like we do a few sessions? And we literally did like 2 sessions, and then like we started to like spread them out, where it's like, okay, you're going to come in for every month for a few months, and then like you're out of here. And then maybe there's, you know, little things that come up, but like, I'm not going to be in your life forever.
Yeah. I appreciate when I go places. I mean, I don't know if it's doctors, chiropractors, physical therapists, you know, therapy stuff I've done, where it's like, the goal is not that my business model thrives if I can get you to come in weekly for the rest of your life. You know, they're almost like, we want you to thrive on your own, and we'll tweak things and give you cues if it's fitness or tactics and strategies, if it's mental health to like calm yourself. I always appreciate when it's a training and an adjustment, as opposed to this kind of lifelong thing. I've learned, as I've done kind of good amount of therapy, is that the things in my world I tried to control that would trigger me were less, and they were usually people I loved, but it was because I couldn't handle how it made me feel. And at times I'll be around other parents, and it happens to me too, where I'm just like, the reason I'm trying to get my child to behave differently is because of how it's triggering me.
Yeah.
And less so trying to help this other person by putting them in therapy or reading books. It's like, dude, have I done my own work so I can even just exist around this other person's process?
Or in like I had a moment this morning where it's like sometimes parents view their child as an extension of them and like what their child is doing and how is that making them look. And so like I have a 5-year-old girl who's in kindergarten, and they did like a worksheet yesterday that said like, what does my friend like to eat and like what do I like to eat? So it's like, oh, this other girl in my daughter's class likes to eat like chicken wings. And I was like, or chicken legs. And so like my 5-year-old drew like, or her version of chicken legs. And then I looked at mine and it was like, I like to eat donuts. And I was like,
because that's all my mom feeds me. Yeah.
Exactly. That's all that I feed her. And I was like, we talk about protein all of the time. Yeah. She couldn't have done like steak or broccoli that she loves. She had to do donuts. Okay. But then I had to check myself of being like, okay, it's not like the kindergarten teacher is not going to like call Child Protective Services because like my 5-year-old put down that she likes to eat like purple icing donuts with
me. That's right. Nice. That's good self-awareness. Well done.
Thank you.
So the folks listening now, we love to kind of go practical. It's like, okay, if you are a parent thinking about a parent, like this matters. I think there is a heaviness to it. I think as a parent, you're going to watch your kids struggle. It's going to make you feel things. So there's probably no easy path to this. I think it's learning to just say, this is part of the process. For those that have kids now that would say, hey, I think I'm doing pretty good. You may, but what are some, do you check in with questions? How do you try to gauge where your kids truly are? If on the surface you're like, they're great, they would never struggle with that, we're a happy family, when a lot of times there's something going on.
Right. And I think that's the thing. Like we can always, one thing that I talk about in my practice is like building your fortress. And like our fortresses have like three sides. There's individual coping skills, there's relationship skills, and then there's like parenting skills. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like kind of the skills and the fortress is like, you could always be learning new skills. So even though I earned my PhD in 2012 and I've been seeing clients for close to 20 years now, it's like I myself still have and I'm developing skills in one of those three areas. And so I think it's taking on that approach, that growth mindset, that you can always be improving. You can always learn either an individual coping skill or a relationship skill or a parenting skill. And so really kind of focusing in on building your fortress, figuring out, okay, where are you at? Where do you need improvement on? Which of those sides is the kind of the shortest side, the least reinforced side, and learning skills in that area. And if one is parenting, because we're focusing a lot on parenting, I have this book up there. It is that book over there that I wrote called The Number 2 Parenting Book, Practical Tips for the Pooped Out Parent. And so it's 29 practical tips for parenting and the time it takes you to poop. A mom poop, not a dad poop, because those are significantly different times.
I appreciate the wordplay there. That's great.
And so one of the tips is talking about like give them just enough. And so it's getting into this developmental theory, but the book doesn't have any real, like, it doesn't, I didn't write anything about like developmental theory. I just kind of give it to you. It's practical.
Yep.
But it talks about like, hey, do just enough for your kids so that they can complete the task successfully themselves. And then like, okay, once they have that, then you like lower the bar a little bit more, and then you lower the bar a little bit more. You continually assess, okay, what skill am I trying to teach my child right now, and how much can they do all by themselves, and how much support do I need to give them in order to have them complete it successfully, and then slowly start taking away that support.
Nice. I like that. Mm-hmm. What would you say if somebody's listening and they're at this point where it's like, nothing I'm doing is working, it's frustrating, my kid's obviously struggling, I don't know what to do, is jumping to therapy, is that like a, hey, there's steps before you get to that? Is that, if you don't know what else to do, that's the place to start? What would you tell those parents?
I would say first step is it the first question I always kind of ask is like, is this therapy, is this worthy of like spending the time and the money and the resources of getting into therapy? Because the wait lists right now are ridiculous. Yeah. And like finding a therapist that I always refer to it as like your therapist, like the person that like you feel comfortable with, that, but who's also going to challenge you, because you don't want to just go in and, like you talked about it, Sten, earlier, like you don't want to just go in and like act like you're talking to your friends. Like, I have enough friends. I hope like other people have enough friends. Like, they shouldn't just want to come in and like talk to me. And like, once it becomes like you're talking to a friend, like it's now time for you to like fly, like be done with therapy. But I think it's, is it getting in the way of you living a high quality life? So is it getting in the way of your financial pieces or financial aspects of life? Is it getting in the way of your social functioning? Is it getting in the way of your relationships? And if the answer to that, any of those questions is yes, and or is it causing you distress on a regular basis, then that's probably time to look for a therapist. And there's lots of different therapies. There's individual therapy, there's family therapy, there's couples therapy, because a lot of the time, depending on what the presenting problems are, some of the time, parents are shocked when I'm like, I'm not going to work with your kid at all. And they're like, what do you mean you're not going to work with my kid at all? And I was like, because I don't need to work with your kid. I need to work with you and give you the parenting skills in order to improve the overall family, not just your kid.
How often is that the case? Because I'm wondering if, is that more often than not, it's more of like the parent needs to do their individual work and just equip themselves better? Because that would be, I mean, pretty challenging to most people, where it's like, my gut is to help this other person, but it's actually me.
So if the child is anxious, there used to be a phrase that one of my supervisors in grad school used to say, like, when there's an anxious child, there's an anxious parent, meaning like they're learning to be anxious from somebody. Wow. I remember I was doing a parenting group, because I do parenting coaching groups, and one of the moms was talking about how she doesn't let her kids take any risks. And I was like, well, if you don't let your kids take any risks, and if you're trying to prevent them from hurting themselves, like jumping from couches, like one couch to another, she like tells them like, no, don't do that. And she like tells them like how to do certain things all of the time. I'm like, you're preventing them from like knowing how to trust themselves.
Wow.
And it completely caught her like off guard. And she's like, that moment, and we talked about it later on, she's like, that was the moment where I realized like, I need to start parenting differently. So I think when there's anxious kids, chances are there's probably an anxious parent that's like modeling that anxiety. So sometimes what I'll do is I'll break up the sessions and I'll do individual therapy with the kid, but then I'll also do some parenting stuff with the parents. Or sometimes what's been happening a lot of the time is that parents will actually just sit in on the therapy, like when we're doing anxiety specific, parents will actually just sit in and like, they're not saying it, but like they're actually doing the coping skills learning the coping skills at the same time. So I think anxiety, I think both parents and kids can benefit. I think there's fewer cases where maybe the parents don't need to be involved, especially if it's teenagers. Mm-hmm. But oppositional defiant disorder. So kids that do the complete opposite of whatever it is that you're telling them to do, or they're just like being defiant, they're not listening, they're not doing what you're asking them to do. A lot of the time, like with those cases, I would say that it's like 85% of the time I'm working with the parents and not the kid.
Wow. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. What would you say to, so a lot of business owners, really driven people seem to be attracted to our industry. There's the selling component, money component. They want to be competitive and thrive in everything they do. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to, And I'm guessing at some point something has to give to thrive and be a great parent while also building a business and doing something that for it to be successful requires a lot of you. What have you experienced with like entrepreneurial business owner people? And, you know, do they always kind of fall short on parenting and that's just kind of the trade-off? Or how would you, or hey, you can't reach your potential in business if you also want to be a great parent. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's interesting that you asked this question, Sten, because just a few weeks ago, one of my colleagues and friends, Alicia Wagner, and I actually delivered a breakout session at a women's leadership summit on mompreneurship.
Oh, good.
So trying to balance being a mom and being an entrepreneur. And I think the thing about it is like you have to figure out and I usually say about 12, like every 12 weeks, reevaluate in this 12 weeks that you are currently in, what is the main goal? What are your top three values? Is it your marriage? Is it building your business? Is it parenting? Is it spirituality / religion? Is it like your personal development? Is it your physical health? Is it your mental health? There's usually 13 values that I run people through. And I'm like, okay, for this next 12 weeks, what are the top three values that you are going to focus in on? And what are those goals that you are trying to achieve? Because I think a lot of the time we try to do everything and we try to do everything really, really well. And it never works out for us because we don't have the bandwidth. And that's okay because we're only humans. And so I think it's kind of like figuring out, okay, like with the 12 weeks that you're currently in, what are the expectations and setting aggressive, achievable yet aggressive expectations or goals for whatever, you know, kind of 12 week period you are in.
I like that. Practically speaking, would that be for the next 12 weeks, I'm going to work on my personal development in therapy, or I'm going to try to do a date night with each one of my kids? What would be some really practical things that you would say are some goals that if you're like, I want to thrive in parenting, I can't be great at everything at one time, but I do want to take a different approach. Mm-hmm. What would some of those things be?
Yeah. So for in regards to parenting, I think the number one because the thing that I struggle with a lot with parents is like, they're always talking about like, I mean, they're overwhelmed. I mean, the U.S. Surgeon General just came out and said how overwhelmed parents are right now. And so like a lot of the time parents view parenting as like this drag. And so like a lot of the time I want to bring the fun back to parenting. And so what you mentioned, Sten, about like dates, taking your kids out individually for dates and letting them choose the things like, what are you doing and what are you eating? And you as the parent are just going along for the ride and you're connecting and you're building that relationship with your child. I think that it brings the fun back. You connect with your child and you learn really important stuff that you might not have learned otherwise. I remember, so I have twin 7-year-olds and we did dates. I remember it was like 2 years ago and they were transitioning from like a private Christian school to like public schools. Mm-hmm. And the public school had let us know, they're like, hey, we're going to separate the twins. And I took each one out to a date by themselves and both of them independently were like, we don't want to be in different classes.
Oh, no.
And I was like, okay. So then I went and I advocated with the principal and I was like, hey, I know this is your policy, but we're changing schools.
Mm-hmm.
They are each other's person.
Yeah.
For kindergarten, can we simply leave them in the same class? And she honored that. And she's like, but then in first grade, we're going to have to separate them. Mm-hmm. They're in second grade now. And like each year, the teachers are like, no, just leave them together because they don't cause, like them being together doesn't cause like issues for either one of them.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could, and I've felt this at times, like it's a lot. It feels like I have to do more on top of all the things I'm doing because parenting is intense. You know, I feel like when I get done with my day, it's like I just left it all on the floor. I think for me, practically, I have to think of like, am I eating well? Am I exercising? Like, am I doing the things I need to do to show up in all parts of my life well? Mm-hmm. And then that means I might have to drop some things that aren't as important. And so I think if it's always more, I think we're all going to get to a point where it's just like, it's just too much and everything's a burden and there's not a lot of things that are fun.
Right. And I think that's the there's another chapter in the book that's dealing with overparenting. And so I think with and this is something that the Surgeon General talked about was that like there's a lot of like we think that we have to parent super intensely and like all of our time has to be spent around parenting our children. But a lot of the time, it's like we don't have to do nearly as much as we think we have to do. It's just like for some reason, it's like, oh, you have to do all these things. And it's like, you know, no, you don't have to do all the things. You can do much fewer things and your kids will be just as successful as they would have if they did, you know, two things versus 20 things.
Yeah. I think accountability and community helps. I know like we coach a lot of advisors that tell us this is the goal. We always want to grow our business, but like if life balance and health, if you can put it out there to somebody else and, you know, if you're hanging out with parents that do date nights, there's a better chance you're going to do date nights. So I would say if you feel alone in this, as we're talking about, or you don't know where to start, mm-hmm. I think community, encouragement, accountability can really help. But as we wrap up, somebody's listening and they're like, hey, you're tapping into like, I know I want to do something differently. Maybe right now they're thinking I want to do more. What would you tell them? Where could they go? They could get that book, which sounds great. Quick read. What would you leave them with as far as we know it's important, but here's the next step to take?
Yeah. So I think there's the book that you can purchase on Amazon. There's also my website, brightspotfamilies.com. You can directly email me from that website. Probably in the next month or two, I'll start up my next, I'll start probably, I think in 2025, I talked to my brand manager earlier today. We're going to do like monthly free workshops, like virtual workshops on different topics that parents are struggling with. So they could join those things. We're going to probably eventually do another round of a group parent coaching program, which is about 3 months. And for those, you get weekly group sessions, you get like a monthly workshop, and then like one 60-minute one-on-one. Right. And then I also offer like individual parent coaching. And so I'm active on LinkedIn, Andrea Mata, PhD. You can find me on there. I think that's how we connected. And so those would all be ways that you can reach out.
I love that. So if anybody has an excuse right now, if I don't know where to go, we just took that away. So take action when you're ready. Andrea, I appreciate you.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You bet.